Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 371. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. What an episode we have for you this week. I have to get started right this very second and introduce our guest. Jane Elliott is an internationally known teacher. She's a lecturer, a diversity trainer. She is the recipient of the National Mental Health Association Award for Excellence in Education. She has made exposing prejudice and bigotry her life's work, and she, without question, has transformed just countless lives. Her world-famous Blue Eyes, Brown Eyes exercise transformed the way we talk about both race and what we all need to be doing to move the needle on equality, equity, anti-racism, harmony. She is an absolute hero of mine and has inspired so much of what it is that I do on this planet. Jane Elliott, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Well, thank you. It's so nice to have it after such an introduction. I'm going to have to be nothing short of brilliant, right?
Jane, do you know how much I had just cut out of that intro in order to have time to talk to you?
Well, I'm certainly glad you cut it out because I just hate it when people lie about me.
We have so much ground to cover, Jane. Are you ready?
Absolutely.
Let's go all the way back. Let's go all the way back to little Jane Elliott running around. Was being a teacher always the dream?
No, I wanted to be a nurse, but my father said he wouldn't help me go to nurse's training. He said, you don't need to be given enemas to those little men. If you'll be a teacher, I'll help you.
And there it is.
And there it is. So if my dad said it, I did it because he was the most moral man I ever knew. Still was the most moral man I have ever known. And if he thought it was the thing to do, then it was the thing to do. My aunts and my older sisters were all teachers, and so my father thought that was the way I should go. He was wrong, but I found out that it was a good idea for me to be a teacher. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. But I really wanted to be a nurse.
You know, I work in a school of education here in Cleveland, Ohio. I work with K through 12 teachers to be. What do you remember about those early days? They always get very nervous before they go in the classroom for the first time.
Early days of teaching, I wasn't nervous about it at all because when I was in school, I went to a rural school and there was one teacher with 20-some kids. So when you were in third grade, you helped the first graders. When you were in fourth grade, you helped the third to second graders. When you were in eighth grade, you were teaching everybody from kindergarten up. So I learned about teaching the easy way. We were, in effect, those in the sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, we were teachers while we were going to school.
Got it.
It was a strange way to run a school, but it was also very effective, and it kept those little kids learning, and it kept those older kids busy.
What were the messages that you received early on about talking about race to third graders, to talking about race to elementary school kids?
The thing that I learned when I went to the University of Northern Iowa, only it was Iowa State Teachers College at that time, from the social studies professor was, don't teach in opposition to the local mores. The people who are paying your wages through their taxes have the right to have their children learn what they want them to learn. So what I was taught in college was, do not teach about racism if you're teaching in a racist community. So, obviously, there was no place in this country where you could teach about racism because this whole country, every little community in this country, has learned the same things. We've all gone to the same schools. We've all read the same history. We've all read the anti-social studies. We've all seen the textbooks with the white males in positions of power in the pictures and everybody else, you know, subservient. So we've all been indoctrinated the same way. None of us have been educated. We've all been indoctrinated in the schools in this country. You can call it another name if you want to, but take another look. And if you think I'm lying about that, you need to read the book, The Racial Conditioning of Our Children, yes. Ending Psychological Genocide in Schools by Nathan Rothstein. Everybody needs to read that book because you won't even think about the lies you've been told. If you haven't read the book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, you at least need to read that one. But you have to read this Nathan Rothstein book. It's absolutely brilliant.
Okay, my syllabus just got one book longer, so my students thank you for that, Jane Elliott. So there
well,
you go.
They have to read that one, and they have to read They Came Before Columbus by Ivan van Sertima, and they absolutely, on the face of the earth, everybody has to read Robert Wald Sussman's book, The Myth of Race. We are all convinced that racism has always been with us. No, slavery has always been with us. But racism, based on skin color, is a relatively new invention created in the 1500s to keep white people on top and make it all right for us to colonize people who are of different colors. It's just an amazing book. When you read it, you'll never look at the topic of race the same again. And the first thing you'll learn on the first page is there's only one race on the face of the earth. We've got to stop talking about all these different races because there's only one. We've got to realize. When I go on a campus now, if any teachers are hearing this, they're going to warn the kids ahead of time. But when I got on a campus to give a speech now, the first thing I say after they introduce me is, to every student or every person in this room who considers himself or herself a member of the white race, please stand. And all those white folks just bounce up, just delighted with themselves, and all the people in the other colors just glare at me. And I say, now, will all the people who consider themselves members of the black race stand? They stand. And brown, yellow, red race, they're all standing. I said, now, is everybody standing? Yes. I said, now, will every person in this room who considers himself or herself a member of the human race, please sit down? There's dead silence, and they all sit right down. And then they look at one another, and it's like, oh God, I never thought of it. We've got to think of it that way. There's only one race. We are all members of the same race. We all have the same ancestor back there 200,000 years ago, and she was a black female. So we need to get over this nonsense of race. It's only been with us for about 500 years. White people created racism. Anything you create, you can destroy. We could destroy racism if we decided to. The schools could make a difference. I made a difference with my third graders, and then my fifth, and my seventh graders, and eighth graders, and now college students, because I refused to accept the myth that there are a number of different races. There's only one, and you and I are members of the same one. And everybody listening to my remarks is one of my cousins. You may not want to be my cousin, but you're stuck with me. That's the way it is. We're all cousins.
I not only want to be your cousin, I'm putting it on my resume that I am your cousin now.
Yeah, you put it. That's a good idea. That's beautiful. Do that. Everybody should put. Oh, that's lovely. I wouldn't have thought of that. Good for you.
I'm always looking for these opportunities. I'm always looking. All right. So the year is 1968. Martin Luther King Jr. has been assassinated. We have to get back to the canon of where this all started for you. Talk us through that night as you remember it, just thinking, okay, I have to incorporate this into what it is that I do.
I can't talk about that without getting sick to my stomach.
Yeah.
Because Martin Luther King Jr. had been one of our heroes of the month in February, along with, unfortunately, George Washington, who owned slaves, bought and sold people for money. Daniel Boone, who was famous for taking over Native American lands, and with great profit. Davy Crockett, who was killed while he tried to kill Mexicans as we tried to take over part of their land. And Abraham Lincoln, who was a racist. But he was also our first black president. And I knew that. I knew that Abraham Lincoln was part Cherokee, part white, and part African American. But we didn't talk about that. We just talked about him as if he were famous. And he said that Negroes should go back to their home in Africa instead of staying here. But I didn't teach those ugly things about those people. I taught what I was told to teach in the social studies text, which was they were our heroes of the month in February. And Martin Luther King was dead in April at the hands of an assassin. I didn't know how to explain that to my kids. I knew I was going to have to go into my classroom the next day and explain that to my students. I was watching Walter Cronkite the night after Martin Luther King Jr. was killed, and he was interviewing... Oh, God, this is painful. He was interviewing three leaders of the black community, mm-hmm. and he said to them, who's going to keep your people in line? I couldn't believe what I had just heard. How could he say such a thing? How could he say when our leader was killed, as if JFK was the leader only of white folks? Mm-hmm. And then, who's going to keep your people in line? As if we white folks were controlled. We controlled ourselves during the killing of our leader, but who's going to keep these crazy blacks in line? I was absolutely appalled, so I changed the channel. And there sat Dan Rather interviewing three black males, and he said to them, don't you Negroes think that you should feel sympathy for us white people during this experience because we can't feel the anger at this killing that you Negroes can? Now, those are the questions those two men asked black leaders the night after Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. And I knew at that moment that not only were we going to discuss this horrendous killing as it was, which was horrendous, But I was going to see to it that they understood at least as much as I did about how that killing took place, why it took place, why Martin Luther King was protesting, what it was he was protesting. And I decided that the next morning, if they didn't understand what we were talking about, since our lesson plan for the day was to learn the Sioux Indian prayer, since we were studying an Indian unit, the Sioux Indian prayer that says, "Oh, Great Spirit, keep me from ever judging a man until I've walked a mile in his moccasins." I decided that the next morning I was going to arrange for half my students to walk in the shoes of a child of color in my classroom for a day. I didn't know how this exercise would work. If I had known how it would work, I wouldn't have done it. If I had known that my children would be beaten, they'd be spit on, their belongings would be destroyed, they would be abused verbally and physically by their peers, by their teachers, and by the parents of their peers, because they had what at that time, and to this day for me, is known as a lover for a mother. Now, I know you hate the sound of that word, but that's what I was called then, and that's what 20% of the people in Riceville call me to this day. If I had known that was going to happen to my children because of this exercise, I wouldn't have done the exercise. If I had known that my parents would lose their business because no one would eat in the restaurant owned by the people who raised me, if I had known that was going to happen, I wouldn't have done the exercise. If I had known that no teacher would speak to me in that system for 12 years because it wasn't good politics to be seen talking to me, if I had known that was going to happen, I might have done the exercise sooner. I found out I had a whole lot more time to teach when I was no longer included in their hall conferences. And my internal environment was a lot less polluted when I no longer had to listen to their racist, sexist, homophobic, ethnocentric, idiotic remarks that I didn't know. And so before I went to sleep that night, I said the only prayer I said at that time, which was, "O Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. O Lord, make me..." Oh, I said it over and over like a mantra. It was as if I was saying the rosary. Within 15 minutes after I started that exercise the next morning, I heard something really valuable. Be careful about what you pray for. You might get it. Yeah. And you might find out that was exactly what you did not want. I did not want to know how it felt to be black in the United States of America. And I didn't know until the next morning when I put my third graders through that exercise. And I put brown-eyed people on top the first day, and I'm blue-eyed. And immediately I found out just a teeny, teeny, tiny bit about how it feels to be treated unfairly on the basis of somebody else's ignorance about the color of your skin or the color of your eyes. It was absolutely terrifying.
I'm going to put aside for a second that when you start the Jane Elliott School of Education, that you will be telling your teachers, ostracize yourself, and then you'll get left alone. We're going to put that lesson aside for a second, though I love it. What did you think was going to happen?
Well, hey, I was a good teacher. I was beloved by my students. I mean, they just loved me, and I just loved them, and we did lots of exciting things. And they trusted me, and I wouldn't lie to them. And I knew that they had a lot of faith in my ability to be fair and my ability to teach. And I thought that that would be what mattered the next day. That did not matter any more than a hill of beans. The minute I told brown-eyed people that they were superior because they had the right amount of melanin in their eyes, they become what this society has taught people to be, who judge people by physical characteristics over which they have no control. Every one of those students knew how to be a racist, and I would have sworn that I had taught them in such a way that they would never behave the way they did that day. I did not expect that to happen. Because, okay, I'm a white woman, and my number one freedom in the United States of America as a white woman is the freedom to be totally ignorant about those who are different from myself. And my number two freedom is the freedom to say, when somebody accuses me of making a racist or sexist or homophobic remark, "Well, you just took it wrong. You just don't understand." I can blame my feeling about another person on that person's physical characteristics instead of taking responsibility for what I'm feeling and what I'm thinking. I can blame it on them. And I, yesterday, last day on Friday, I did a college in Illinois. And somebody said, "They dislike me because I'm black." I said, "No, they don't dislike you because you're black. That's not the reason they dislike you. They dislike you because they're ignorant about skin color. Now stop taking responsibility for their dislike of you. You're taking responsibility for their ignorance." And that's what I did then for about 10 years after I did that exercise. I blamed myself for the way people felt about me. I let them off the hook. Yeah. We've got to stop blaming skin color for the problem in this country and admit that it is not white privilege, it is white ignorance. And after the age of 15, it is self-imposed ignorance.
Look, this is no marring on your teaching whatsoever, but there's not even a part of me that thinks that you could have predicted how big this would become. How do you prepare yourself for all of that attention?
Oh, I didn't think there was going to be any attention. That wasn't supposed to get out of my classroom, and it wouldn't have. But the third day, we did the exercise on Friday. Then I sent him home for the weekend. Then on Monday, we reversed the exercise. It was ungodly. Then on Tuesday, I had each child write a four-paragraph composition telling who Martin Luther King Jr. was, how the child felt on Friday, how the child felt on Monday, and what discrimination is. When they had finished writing their compositions, we got in a circle, and they could all share what they had written. They all wanted to share what they had written. I learned again. I learned more that day than I had ever learned before. And so did those kids from hearing one another's compositions and from hearing one another how they felt when they were on the bottom and how good they felt when they were on the top. It was absolutely amazing. I showed those to my mother. She showed them to the local newspaper editor. He asked if he could print them. There are no secrets in my classroom. I said, sure, go ahead and print them. The kids said, I asked the kids, and they said, let's do that. They thought they were going to be famous. They didn't know how unpleasant fame is. So the local newspaper printed those editorials, those essays, and then all hell broke loose. Then people started to say, what in the world is she doing with those poor little children in that classroom in Riceville, Iowa? It got real sticky real fast.
Wow. Wow.
That wasn't supposed to happen. I did lots of interesting things in my classroom. None of them were supposed to, they were not to be out of my classroom. There were things that applied to the outside world, but I wasn't teaching about I was teaching about the outside world, but I was teaching it in a way that third graders could understand. When we opened the Room 10 store so that every kid could go Christmas shopping and buy things that other kids had brought in that they had either outgrown or outworn or something their parents couldn't use, and they bought and sold those and used Room 10 money and then wrapped them and gave them to their brothers and sisters for Christmas or their peers. And then the next year, kids came in third grade wearing the clothes that their brothers and sisters had purchased in third grade the year before. See, I think school ought to extend out of the classroom. I think that what you do in the classroom should be about what's going on in the present outside the classroom in order to make the future better. Instead of just studying the past, I think we ought to talk about what's going on in the future that will be the past in the future. We've got to make the present better, or it's going to be an ugly past for our children to remember.
Again, listeners, we are here with teacher, lecturer, diversity trainer, Jane Elliott. So I will ask you, Jane Elliott, the question that has come up so many times in my classes over the years as we have witnessed the incredible work that you have put forward. If you walked into a third grade classroom and did your brown eye, blue eye exercise as you did it 50 years ago, would the effect still be the same?
If I walked into a classroom and did this exercise today, I get exactly the same results. Because I get the same results when I do this with adults.
Yes.
40 adults at a time in corporations all over the United States and in England and in Australia and in Canada. I get the same results that I got with those third graders. And the reason I do is because most of us grow older. Some of us grow up. Most of us don't grow up. We maintain our child and parent ego state for our whole lifetime. And that's what's wrong with Donald Trump. Dinosaurus P. Rump is in his child ego state most of the time. It's difficult to deal with someone, adult to adult, when you have to deal adult to child.
Right.
So then you have to go parent to child. Then in order to be around that man, you have to be in your parent ego state. And then when he gets into his parent ego state, you've got to go into your child ego state in order for him to be able to relate to you or to communicate with you. And we're doing a horrible thing in the schools, in talking down to children, in expecting less of them, and then wondering why they don't learn more. Kids will live down to our expectations of them. As little as you expect of them, that's what you'll get. As much as you expect of them, that's what you'll get. Every child is much brighter than we allow any of them to be. How many times have you, as a teacher or as a student, asked a question in the classroom and had the teacher say to you, "We aren't there in that book yet. Wait until we get there in the textbook." Have you had that happen?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, see, when a kid asks a question, if it has anything at all to do with the subject matter at hand, you need to say, "That's an interesting question. let's research that. Why don't we learn about this for today? Because what we were learning about wasn't all that important. But if this is something you're interested in doing, let's talk about this today. And then learn that other thing, and then you've got that kid for the rest of the year. He will love you forever because you cared about what he thought about, what he was concerned about, what he wanted to learn about. But instead, they have to learn about what we want them to learn about, whether it makes any sense at all.
You know, Jane, I'm going to air this episode, and I will tell you right now, I will guarantee it, I will get listeners writing in and say, that's great, Jane Elliott's great, that's a very interesting message that she had, we have more work to do, but this show is so gay. Why are you featuring Jane Elliott on This Show Is So Gay? And try as I might, for however long I've been doing this work, getting folks to see the intersections between talking about sexual orientation and talking about race and this fight for equality in which we are all involved seems to still elude people.
Let me help you with that.
Please.
Stop fighting for equality.
Yeah.
I don't fight for equality. I know that I will never be equal to you. I will never be as tall as you are. I'll bet you're over 5'1", aren't you?
I am.
I'll never be as young as you are. I'll bet you're younger than 82, aren't you?
I am.
I'll bet you know more about computers than I do, don't you?
I possibly do.
I'll bet you know a whole lot more about LGBTQ issues than I do, don't you?
Possibly, yes.
No, there's no possibly.
Yes.
You know you do. I know more about women than you do.
Yes.
And what I know is not all great, but I know a whole lot about women.
Yes.
And I know something about men, and I know a whole lot about white folks. And I'm willing to learn about people of color, and I'm trying to learn about LGBTQ, but a lesbian came up to me after I was finished speaking last Friday in Springfield and said, well, I think that you spent too little time on a group of people who are absolutely mistreated in this country on a daily basis. And I let her go on and on and on, and I knew what was coming on. I knew what she was doing. I knew what she was saying. And finally said, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, but you need to know that you can mask the fact that you're lesbian.
Yes.
That black man standing there, the minute he walks into a room, everybody knows. They don't have to have their gaydar out. They know when they look at him that that man is black. And they immediately assign negative stereotypes to him because of what they think they know about black people. Now, am I right about that?
You are right about that.
Yeah, well, see, if you see the film The Angry Eye, there's a young woman in there with, well, I think she's got every place she can have pierced on herself, and she's obviously, she's a lesbian, and she's an absolutely delightful, but she's angry because we're talking about black.
Right.
And she argues about that and lets me know that, come on now, what about my issue? So she isn't listening to the black issue. All she's concerned with is her issue. And we do the thing, and she's standing up I'm standing between her, short, just a lovely lesbian, obviously female, and a Rasul, a large black male. And I ask the students if they see any differences there. They say height. They say race, and I have to stop them on that. What race do you think he's a member of? Well, a black race. Well, there's no such thing. That's not right. What are you talking about? Skin color. We go through that, and her eyes get more and more and more moist. And finally, she turns so she doesn't see, the camera doesn't see that she's got tears in her eyes. Because she's learning something she hasn't had to think about before. They immediately saw the difference. Immediately. Nobody said sexual orientation. Nobody said that because that isn't obvious, but skin color and height and weight and age and gender are all perfectly obvious. And those are the things on which we get judged immediately. I went back a month later to debrief the group, and they filmed the debriefing and interviewed this young woman. And she said, all I can say is, if you didn't learn something from what went on here today, it sucks to be you.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me push you a little bit harder on that one, because I think part of my struggle is, and what we see often in the LGBTQ community, is that the LGBTQ community, the white LGBTQ community, is not often doing even remotely nearly enough to show up for our brothers and sisters of color in their fight.
Absolutely not. See, that's a kind of a normal human reaction. During the civil rights movement, if white women had gotten off their polyunsaturated fatty acids and gone to work on the civil rights movement, the women's movement would have gotten a lot further, a lot faster. But instead, the government allowed the women's movement to usurp the civil rights movement. It effectively killed the civil rights movement because the women who were fighting for rights were white women.
Right.
Now, if those had been lesbians, we'd still be fighting for women's rights because they would have been judged on the basis of people's ignorance about homosexuality.
Yeah.
But the women's movement, as far as I'm concerned, effectively killed the civil rights movement. We could have made a huge difference if every white woman had stepped up to the plate and said, no, by the gods of war, you're not going to do this to my black relatives, and every human being on the face of this earth is one of my relatives, and you're not going to be allowed to treat them that way. Then blacks would have said, when the women's movement started, then blacks would have said, you joined our movement, now we'll join yours, and we'll change this thing around. But instead, we allowed white men, people who are in power in this country, to play us against one another.
Yeah,
it's a constant game of aligning people against one another, which is exactly what this election this year is all about.
Right.
That's exactly what Donosaurus T. Rump is involved in doing. It's called divide and conquer, and he's got it down to the knit on a gnat, and people are allowing him to do it.
Yeah.
Because we're so afraid that white people are going to be in the numerical minority in this country within 30 years. And we are. And that's a fact. And you can whine and cry and deny it until hell freezes over. It's still going to happen. Except that Donosaurus T. Rump has the answer. He says, keep those brown people out of this country because they reproduce too fast. And that will slow down white people becoming a minority in this country. If you think I'm lying about that, then you need to read Ben Wattenberg's book, The Birth-Dearth. Have you read that?
I have not read that.
Get Ben Wattenberg's book, The Birth-Dearth. Ben Wattenberg was an advisor to presidents of the United States. He wrote a book called The Earth-Dearth, and he was a member of the American Enterprise Institute. You know what they are.
Yes.
They're about as right-wing as you can be.
Oh, yeah.
And he advised presidents of the United States. And the first paragraph, the first page of his book says, the number one problem confronting the United States today is there aren't enough white babies being born in this country. If we don't change this immediately, white people will be in the numerical minority, and this will no longer be a white man's land. Now, I have a feeling that if you talk to Native Americans, they'd say this never was a white man's land, but that's the way we white folks talk. And then he discusses the three ways to change this situation. He says, number one, we could pay women to have babies as they have been doing in Western European nations for years. But, he says, unfortunately, and these are his words, not mine, we would have to pay women of all colors to have babies, so we don't want to do that. He says the second thing we could do is increase the number of legal immigrants allowed into this country every year. Then he says, unfortunately, the majority of those wanting to come to this country every year are people of color, so we don't want to do that. Then he says, the third thing we can do is remember that 60% of the fetuses that are aborted every year are white. If we could keep that 60% alive, that would solve our birth dearth. Now, he doesn't say what he wants to do with the other 40% who are fetuses of other color groups. He only says what he wants to do with the 60% that are white. As I understand it, this book, I think, was written in 1987. When did the Right to Life movement start? And when are we going to realize that that is not the Right to Life movement, that's the Right to White Life movement?
Yes. Yeah.
See, I know now what people are going to say is, well, she's a conspiracy theorist. No, I'm not. I read these things, and then I think, wait a minute, when did this and this and this and this happen? Well, this isn't a conspiracy. This is just real good organization. And Donosaurus T. Rump is taking advantage of it. And he is scaring white folks to death. Now, I ask people of color whether, if they get power, they're going to want to get even. They say no. All they want is to get equity.
Right.
They don't want to get even. They don't want to get equality. They want to get equity, which is equitable treatment under the law. We are promised that in the Constitution of the United States. We aren't promised equality. We are equal in the eyes of God, but lots of people don't believe in God, number one. And most of us don't work with God all day, every day. We work with fallible human beings who do not see us as equals and who are not our equals. But we are promised equitable treatment under the law. Now, the founding fathers were very smart to put that word in there instead of equality. Because, you see, women and the LGBTQ group and people of color have been fighting for equality for about 300 years. You can fight for equality until hell freezes over. You aren't going to get it because we're never all going to be equal. You, as President Eisenhower said, you can't legislate morality. So we legislated immorality, which is what happened with this last Supreme Court, some of the last Supreme Court decisions. They've legislated immorality when you make a corporation a person.
Right.
We can legislate morality. We do it all the time. We could legislate, you can't legislate love. I really don't care whether people love me. If you treat me fairly, I'll treat you fairly, and we may end up loving one another. If you don't treat me fairly, but you say, I'm doing this because I love you, sure, I'm not going to love you, and I'm not going to treat you fairly.
Yeah.
We've got the whole thing upside down. We teach the golden rule. Oh, my Lord, we teach the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. Treat others the way you want to be treated. No. It was in Chinese philosophy that Jesus probably found it in Chinese philosophy, and it said, treat others the way they want to be treated, not the way you want to be treated. I don't have the right to treat you, a gay male, the way I, a staid female, want to be treated. You know that, and so do I. I don't have the right as an old woman to treat you, a young man, the way I want to be treated. I have to treat you the way you want to be treated, and in order to find out how you want to be treated, I have to ask you. And then I have to listen to your answer, and if what you want is neither illegal, immoral, or indecent, I have to do it, because I asked you how you want to be treated. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Well, it begs the question to me, Jane, what does it look like? You've been doing this for so long. You've worked with so many audiences. What does it look like to you when someone gets it? When someone has that light bulb moment, what does that look like to you?
Oh, man, you can see it when they've gotten it. About three months ago, I did a program with a college in California someplace. And we were standing out in the hall after it was over, and all the kids were doing selfies. And I was tired, and I wanted to go home. And this kid, this skinny young male, came down the hall, and I swear, he's pulling about a foot off the ground. And both his eyes were out to the side, almost in an attitude of prayer. And he said, Elliot, I've got to talk to you. I said, what do you want? He said, I've got to thank you. I said, what for? He said, you just made me freer than I've ever been in my life. I don't have to live up to those superior things anymore, that attitude that I have to be superior. I can just be comfortable with me myself. And this young black female standing there beside me said, and I don't have to live down to those inferior attitudes, inferior opinions, those stereotypes. I can be myself. It was like, oh, my God, if I die standing here, I have not lived in vain, because here are two young people who know that they are members of the human race, that we're all in this thing together, and you don't have to live up to or down to somebody else's idea of you because of the color of their ignorance about the color of your skin.
Yeah.
There's a passage in this racial condition, and that everybody should read, about the things that we could have avoided if we hadn't been so determined to perpetuate isms. This is just an extremely interesting book. Everybody has to read The Racial Conditioning of our children, because there are a couple of passages in there that just oh, you think, okay, I should have learned this a long time ago. And the first time I read this, I thought, I should have learned this a long time ago. And maybe it just seems like genius to me because it's what we've been talking about for 48 years. I've been doing this for 48 years. How long, oh God, do we have to keep on before so-called intelligent white people get a clue that the idea of four different races, that is a myth, and it is just as real as the Greek myth that said that the sun was a god in a golden chariot that flies across the sky every morning. The two myths are equally factual and equally sensible.
Has there ever been one of those workshops that got too intense for even you, Jane Elliott?
No.
No.
No, because you see, when I do the workshop, if you know anything about transactional analysis.
Oh, yeah.
You know, yeah, in order to do the workshop and have it work, the facilitator, the director, has to be in his or her parent ego state, which forces all the participants into their child ego state, particularly the blue-eyed ones. But then you've talked to the brown-eyed people as if they're in their adult ego state. So while you're standing there doing it, you go from parent to adult, but you never go into child, but you force the blue-eyed people into their child ego state, and they have no choice. Within 5 minutes after you start the exercise, you've got blue-eyed adult educated, really, really high status, blue-eyed males acting like five-year-olds.
Yeah.
Because inside every one of us are those five-year-old behaviors and reactions. And no, it has never. I've been hit by a white male during this exercise. Three carloads of blacks had to take me out of Uniontown at midnight because the 400 plus teachers, I guess, that I put through the exercise in a very, very informal way in the morning had called the superintendent in the afternoon and said, "If you don't get that bitch out of town, we're gonna shoot her."
Oh my God!
So that was that was scary, and I didn't know what had happened until Anna S. Cunningham, who was head of the human relations or whatever it is in Pennsylvania at that time, was taking me to Harrisburg just as far as fast as she could go and shaking, and I didn't know what they were all shaking about. We got to the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and the other three carloads turned around and went back, and I said, "What is going on here? What's happening?" And then she told me, and I thought, oh, my, and I said, "I'm sorry. I put you people in danger." She said, "We've put you in danger. We've got to get you out of town." And it was like, oh, my God. And these are teachers that I did it with. I did it with the White House Conference on Children and Youth in 1970. We put 140 teachers, preachers, psychologists, psychiatrists, lawyers, doctors, all the people who are instrumental in making lives better for children, 140 of them in the forum called Children Without Prejudice, and we put them through the blue-eyed, brown-eyed exercise. They went nuts. They went absolutely bonkers. And I thought, wait a minute, you people are all educated, and they were because they said so. But the minute you use the exercise with them, it is so unfair that it reminds them of what life was like when they were 3 and 5 and 7 and 10 years old, and they become what they were like in those ages. It's just fascinating. And you won't believe it until you've done it or until you've seen it done. And then all of a sudden you realize, oh my, I've got to help these people get through this.
Yeah.
Because they fall apart in front of your very eyes. They just go, they literally... Can white, blue-eyed white people, particularly males, cannot tolerate for an hour, an hour and a half, 2 hours, what they expect people of color to tolerate for a lifetime in this country. You can't do it.
What's so amazing about that to me, and we talk about this endlessly in class, and we've certainly used the angry eye, is that you would think that on some level, and you have said this over and over again, that on some level you have these participants thinking, okay, it's an exercise. I'm going to get through this. But then you have individuals in these workshops who have their privileges taken away for an extraordinarily short amount of time, knowing that their privileges are going to be restored to them, and they use...
No. It isn't their privileges that you're taking away. You're taking away their status.
Their status.
You're taking away their humanity. You're taking away their experiential background. You're taking away the very their identity. You are robbing them of their identity. Do not say you're taking away their privileges. Forget the word privileges as much as you can, because you're not taking away their privileges. You're taking away their ego. You are robbing them of their identity, which is what we do with people of color on a daily basis in this country.
Right.
And we expect them, as we say to them, why don't you just get over it? How many times have you heard somebody say to a person of color, why don't you just get over it?
Yes.
And we say that to them when they've had it happen to them after when they got on the bus this morning, or when the bus refused to stop for them, or when the taxi wouldn't pick them up, or when the person at the store said, put the bill on the counter, so they wouldn't have to touch their fingers, the clerk wouldn't have to touch the fingers of that black person in order to get their money from them.
Right.
And then they put the change on the counter so that they don't have to put it in their hands. That has happened to them before they get to your classroom.
Right.
Or they've been in the elevator. Some black man has been in the elevator. And a woman, the door opens, and a white woman is standing there, and she says, I'll take the next elevator. The minute she sees that black man standing there, or a black man gets on the elevator, and there are three or four white women there, and they all go to the other corner of the elevator.
Right.
As far from him as they can get. As if it were catching, or as if white women are so wonderful that every black man on the face of the earth is warm for their form. Get over it, ladies.
Wow. You have to know that I have never been speechless on my own show, and I just feel like there's so much work to do. And sometimes, as someone who does this work, I feel a little bit incapacitated. And I will use the word privilege here because I do think that that is a privilege of mine. That sometimes I feel like, all right, I'm going to step away from this work, which I'm able to do because I'm a white male and I can step away from this every time because it's not my lived experience. Help me, help all of our listeners who are just saying, no, it's just too tough. I don't know what to do next. What do we do next, Jane Elliott? Well,
number one, I suspect that many of your listeners are Christians.
Yeah.
And believe the good book in which it talks about the family of man. When you look, and it is so freeing to see, for me, to see three young black men coming toward me on the street. And I think, there are some of my cousins, and they don't even know it. But those are my relatives. Those are my relatives. And when somebody gives them a sidelong glance and says something sneery behind their hand to me about them, I turn and say, wait just a minute. Those three guys are related to me. And they look at me like, oh, my God, are you one of those? I must be black. I say, no, you don't understand. We're all members of the same family, the same race. Those are all members of my race and my family. Don't make those remarks to me. My son-in-law says, you have to know your audience. So, folks, I would advise you the next time you start to automatically make a racist remark because you're in an all-white group, that you remember that you aren't in an all-white group. You're in an all-mosaic group. You're in a group in which all of us have the same ancestor, which was a black female 200,000 years ago. And we are all members of the same race. And when you offend one of my family members, I don't appreciate it. I won't tolerate it. And if I'm in the group in which you make those statements, I'll come after you. And I won't deny your right to freedom of speech. I believe in the right to freedom of speech because I read Nat Hentoff's book, Free Speech for Me, But Not for Thee. And if you haven't read it, you better get it and read it. Because I don't believe in political correctness. I don't believe in that. What I do believe in is if you're going to make ugly statements, you have to realize that you will live with the consequences of that behavior. And if you have the freedom to make those ugly statements, I have the freedom to respond to them. And the response that you might get from them may be much, much worse than it would have been if you just kept your mouth shut. Sometimes it's a good idea if you've got one of those stereotypical remarks about to come out of your mouth, shut your mouth. Cut the duck up. Just do that for yourself, because more and more there are people in this country who are going to say, you're talking about my relatives, and then they won't tolerate your saying those things about their relatives. Elie Wiesel said, I went to a speech that he gave at Luther College in Decorah one night, and he said, you must not tolerate the intolerable. If it is intolerable for one of your brothers or sisters, and that's what we all are on this earth, then it's intolerable for you. You must not tolerate the intolerable, because what we allow them to do to others today, they will do to us tomorrow.
There it is.
And you know that. As a gay male, you know that. You know that we can use the same techniques against gays and lesbians, and have, that we've used against blacks and other people of color, because we use how we treat blacks as the model for how we treat all those others that we consider not quite right enough.
All right, listeners, this is what I need you guys to do. You need to stroll on over to janeelliott.com. We will certainly link to it. You have to go on over to Amazon or anywhere where fine books are sold and pick up a copy of A Collar in My Pocket, Blue Eyes, Brown Eyes Exercise, because that's an incredible text. I barely know how to wrap up with you, Jane. I don't think I can properly express how much you make up the bedrock of how I approach this work, how there's so much that I do that is rooted in being inspired by you and knowing, look, there's so much work to be done, and sure, we could sit in a corner and not do anything, but that doesn't make this world better. And
may I make one suggestion here?
Please.
Stop saying gays and straights. The opposite of straight is bent, misshapen, or crooked. My gay and lesbian friends and relatives are not bent or misshapen. Many of them are crooked because they have to be to survive in this society, this horribly judgmental society. But instead of saying gay and straight, use gay and stayed. The opposite of gay in the thesaurus is stayed. One of the opposites is stayed, S-T-A-I-D. Now, it has the same first two letters that straight has the same long A spelling, A-I, and it doesn't have any negative connotations. So instead of gay and straight, let's say gay and stayed, just that one thing. If you say that in a group, then they all straighten up. They don't stay up, but they straighten up and think, what's that all about? And then you explain it to them. Just that one little difference in the language. Words have consequences. Words have power. Somebody has said the most powerful weapon devised by humankind is words. We use words to kill people all day, every day. We write laws in words. So the way we use words will determine how this whole society functions, is the way we use words. We've got to change the way we use words. I refuse to call people who aren't gay straight. As far as I'm concerned, they're stayed.
I will make that switch. Look, I'm going to tell you this, my cousin Jane Elliott, because I'm putting that on my resume. My cousin Jane Elliott. My hope is, first, that you understand what a difference you've made in this world. You do, on some level, understand that, right?
No, I don't think that. Let me put this perfectly plainly to you. I haven't made much of a difference. But the people who listen to me and who learn and then go out and change things and change the way they see things. And once you've been through the blue-eyed, brown-eyed exercise, it changes your brain. It literally changes your brain. The people who are doing the documentary on science of the brain say that this exercise changes people's brains. Once a group of people, one or two or three out of any group that I talk to, go out and make a change, then they are the ones who have made the change. I haven't. They are the ones who decide to do or not to do. To be or not to be, that really is the question. To be busy or to just sit back and take it. No, that's not what we want. That's not. And number one, don't call me a trainer. I'm not a trainer. We train chickens and ducks and treat horses and dogs. I'm not a trainer. I'm an educator. And the word, and so are you. And the word educator comes from the root duck deuce, which means lead, the prefix e, which means out, the suffix ate, which means the act of, and the suffix or, which means one who does. So an educator is one who is engaged in the act of leading people out of ignorance. That's what I try to do.
And that is what you have done. In perhaps the biggest understatement I have ever said in 8 years and 371 episodes of this show, I am so appreciative of you using your voice in the way you've used it. You really have inspired me, Jane, and I am appreciative.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to have my voice heard, because strange as it is, I didn't learn any of this from white folks. What I know I've learned, or from staid folks, what I know I've learned from listening to people who were neither members of the white group nor members of the staid group, because they know more than I do, because they've had more experiences than I've had, and because they have developed coping skills that I will never develop, which my kids had to develop because of what I do for a living.
Yeah.
So thank you for giving me the opportunity to say that.
Jane, please keep doing what you're doing.
I probably will. I have to. I have no choice. Some people have a choice. I don't have a choice anymore.
All right, folks, and we are back. Jane Flippin' Elliott, just an absolute hero of mine. And to have her just hold court on this show as she just did, incredible. Incredible experience for me. I hope it was an incredible experience for you. If you have a hero that you think should be on our show, just drop me an email. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com, and we will try to get them on. We don't have a ton of time left on this week's episode, but let's get to some of the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. President Obama has made his last ever United Nations speech as the United States president, and he used it to condemn anti-LGBT violence. In the speech at the UN, President Obama warned U.S. voters against embracing isolationism and ultranationalism in November's presidential election. He also warned against discriminating against minority groups, saying, quote, "I do not believe progress is possible if our desire to preserve our identities gives way to an impulse to dehumanize or dominate another group. If our religion leads us to persecute those of another faith, if we jail or beat people who are gay, if our traditions lead us to prevent girls from going to school, if we discriminate on the basis of race or tribe or ethnicity, then the fragile bonds of civilization will fray. The world is too small. We are too packed together for us to be able to resort to those old ways of thinking." President Obama speaking at the UN. That could have been Jane Elliott speaking at the UN. That was her message as well. It's good stuff, good stuff. Hey, our thoughts are with all of our brothers and sisters, mostly our sisters, who have been working tirelessly over at AfterEllen.com. It's a popular lesbian blog. They are closing down after more than a decade. It was announced this week that the Hub for Lesbian News and Culture, published by Evolve Media, will be shutting down this week. After Ellen first launched in 2002, it was named after Ellen DeGeneres, and they have overseen a boom in LGBT culture. The site's editor-in-chief, Trish Bendix, confirmed the news on her own Tumblr account, lamenting the loss of a specific hub for queer women. She wrote this, quote, "Here are the facts. Evolve Media purchased After Ellen from Viacom 2 years ago. They gave us 2 fiscal years to become their LGBT property and profit in that space, and they found we are not as profitable as Moms and Fashion." And yes, they are mainly white heterosexual men, which is important to note because not only is this the story for us, but for a lot of other properties, large-scale media outlets, lesbian bars outpriced by neighborhoods they helped establish, housing in queer meccas like Portland that is being turned into condos and Airbnbs. At the very same time, queer women and culture are being celebrated on the Emmys in the legalization of both mothers being included on their newborn's birth certificate and our namesake Ellen DeGeneres being one of the most well-known, well-liked, and undeniably profitable television and lifestyle personalities of our generation. Trish Bendix added this, quote, "Evolve has decided to keep the site and its archives alive for now with a promise of periodically publishing freelance pieces in the future." So again, our thoughts are with our sisters and maybe a couple brothers who are working over there at AfterEllen.com. We have certainly been using their information for years and years, and we celebrate what they have done. An incredible, incredible site that has done so much good for the community. Turning our attention to the great state of Kentucky, homophobic county clerk Kim Davis, we just can't seem to get rid of her. She's being sued now for over $200,000 after she refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples last year. The American Civil Liberties Union said it is seeking to recover money it paid to lawyers to represent a number of couples who were denied marriage licenses in Rowan County, Kentucky, because of county clerk Kim Davis. The amount it is looking to recuperate is in excess of $233,000. Just to remind you, not that you need a reminder, but just to remind you, Kim Davis refused to issue licenses last year after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that same-sex marriage was legal in all 50 states. 4 couples, 2 same-sex ones and 2 straight ones, sued Davis in her capacity as county clerk for refusing to issue licenses to anyone following the ruling. She was jailed for several days. Now she is being sued for $233,000. Recently, in a funny part of the story, Mike Huckabee was forced to pay $25,000 in a settlement for playing Eye of the Tiger at a rally in support of Kim Davis. Mike Huckabee, $25,000. Because he thought, all right, I'm going to play something victorious in support of Kim Davis. Well, he played Eye of the Tiger. He did not have permission to do so. And there you go, $25,000. We'll see how that goes. $233,000 she is on the line for right this very second. ex-gay billboards promoting gay cure therapies will now be taken down following complaints from the LGBT community in a small town in Texas. In response to a billboard by Parents and Friends of Ex-Gays, PFOX, not the greatest acronym, but PFOX, the LGBT community in Waco, Texas decided to hold their own pride event in 2017. The billboard read, "Ex-gays prove change is possible." The company behind the billboards, Swift Media, have confirmed that they will come down by the end of October after complaints by the founder of Inter Waco, which is an organization down there. The founder of InterWaco said this, quote, "The people that own the company don't want any controversy. They don't want to fall down on either side. When I explained to them what reparative therapy is, they had no idea." Swift Media has said the billboards will come down and that it will not renew its contract with PFOX. The pastor at Central Texas Metropolitan Community Church, Charlie Garrison, spoke out against the billboards. He told one television affiliate this, quote, "Ex-gays implies there's something wrong with gay, lesbian, and transgender people. Ex-gay therapy does not do any good and, in fact, can do harm in increasing the suicide rate in the LGBTQ community." So there you go. Some billboards coming down. That's what happens when you use your voice. If you see something, say something. This applies to anti-gay things you see out there. It should apply to racist things you see out there. There's an example right now at Quinnipiac University where a white student who's wearing a mud mask put a picture of herself online with the caption, "Black Lives Matter." No, that's not okay. And other students spoke up and said, this is not okay. And it forced Quinnipiac to take action. If you see something, you actually do need to say something. Final story. I don't even know what to do with this story. So Chadwick Moore, who's been on this show many, many times, he writes for The Advocate, he writes for Out Magazine. Well, he just did a profile. It's a profile, not a news story, a profile of Milo Yiannopoulos, the alt-right troll who says just horrible, horrible things. Well, this profile, very much as profiles do, humanizes Milo, and many in the LGBT community are not happy about that at all. Noah Michelson over there, the editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post Queer Voices section, is one of the many people who has taken to online social media places and said, it's just not okay. It's not okay to humanize this guy who says such horrible anti-gay things, who says such horrible anti-women, racist, horrible things out there. It's not okay, Out Magazine, to humanize him, to give him this media space to continue to disavow himself of all of his many followers. He says he's not responsible for his many followers who say all of these terrible, terrible things. Well, many people not happy with Out Magazine right now. So even within the LGBTQ community, if you see something, you should say something, because it will certainly bring about more conversation. Conversation does not happen when we don't say things, and change certainly does not happen when we keep silent. So use your voice. You know who used her voice? Jane Elliott. Did incredible things, continues to do incredible things. Our huge thanks to her. Go strolling over to janeelliott.com. There's a ton of resources over there. And you guys, you know what to do. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference. It really will do so, both in your life and the lives of those around you. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?